This is Real-Time Overview for Friday, December 14th, 2018. Thanks for hanging in this week for this late episode. I am your host, Michael Feenan. Earlier this week, part one of our season finale released, with part two coming to you in just over one more week. Aaron and I are looking back on our first year of production and just having some fun while doing it before getting ready for season two next year. Thanks for listening all these months, and here's looking forward to another year. As for right now, I've got some articles for you. As more sites readily move towards forcing HTTPS for all users and the availability of tools like Let's Encrypt increases, the topic of website security is something that you can't spend enough time on. It's not necessarily a fun or sexy subject, but it is a necessity and one that you need to be familiar with if you plan to help anyone deploy a site. It's one more cog in the machine that includes things like GDPR compliance and protecting your users' data. The Int64 software blog has a starter article by Matt Stacey that opens up this subject by looking at website headers and how they factor into securing your site. It's a good place to start, too, because even if you're just using a WordPress site on shared hosting, you can impact some of these issues compared to someone running their own complete server who needs to deal with the much broader subject of server security. He starts by reviewing the most basic part of this subject, which is a rundown of which security headers will be important to you if you want to make sure your site is safe to use. It's a good review that will help familiarize yourself with a number of topics you'll see in the future, particularly content security policies. Matt goes on to provide example header setups for a number of different approaches, whether you're going to tackle it at the server level in Apache or Nginx, or at the application level using PHP or ASP. It's not a deep dive into it, but the examples should give you a model to start with. After that, you can go further and learn more on website security by reading the other three parts in this four-part series. If you're a WordPress user, check out the show notes and I'll link a simple tutorial on how to add headers to your theme. Otherwise, run by the Int64 software blog to learn about security headers. Over time, whether as a designer or a developer, we'll usually spend some time coming to the realization that to be successful, you need to have skills outside of your comfort area. This manifests in many ways, and thanks to the amount of freelance work out there, one of the most common areas is business. If you head over to the Beyond Users blog, they've put together a guide that advocates for this, but goes one step further to suggest 7 things every designer should know about business. After all, you're almost certainly doing what you do to make money. And when you leave it on the table, you're risking your future. They've broken the guide up into 7 sections that get progressively more specific, going from industry-level concepts to product-level, with the idea of helping you understand how you break down the different areas to identify value that you could be tapping into. From the iPhone to design metrics, you'll learn how to craft and position ideas to users, as well as how to sell them to businesses. While the title of this piece is targeted at designers, I think you could easily put equal value on this for developers out there. The concepts aren't hyper-specific and can be applied regardless of what your specialty is. Hit up the Beyond Users blog to catch this piece and learn more about business strategy, and let us know what your favorite tips are by leaving us a comment at the show notes. If you've written enough CSS in your life, you know that when you graduate to SAS, you inevitably run into the earliest questions involving variables. What do you name your color variables? This is a question tackled by Chris Coyer over at CSS Tricks this week in his article, which doesn't so much prescribe one answer, but instead takes a look at many different techniques you might consider using. Color lends itself to this question in an interesting way, largely because colors can be frequently changed on a website, and we tend to have a wide array of them that can be very similar. At scale, it can become inefficient trying to change all these references to a single color, so when we turn them into variables, it allows us to make one change that filters everywhere. It's funny to me reading this article, because as Chris goes through the different approaches, I find myself realizing I've used a frightening number of them at different times, especially as it would apply to monochrome palettes. Medium gray, dark gray, medium gray 2, and so on. For my part, I've recently settled on using the abstracted color names closest to what I'm using to maintain the differences between shades. Which pattern is right for you will partly depend on how you work and what you're working on. For instance, using numbered levels or a light, medium, dark approach can become problematic if you find yourself inserting shades over time. Likewise, using color names is better when the shades might change slightly, but still gives you the same find and replace hurdles that you would face just hard coding the colors because of their specificity. Shoot us a message on Twitter and let us know which pattern works best for you and why. We'd love to hear what you folks are using. Your long read of the week comes from Ferdy Christent with a piece from his blog looking ahead at the future of browsers in a world with Chromium domination now that Microsoft will be adopting it. This is a follow-up to a previous article he wrote that we'll link to in the show notes that looks at the somewhat challenging landscape of browsers as it exists today. While his first article had a somewhat blunt tone to it about the problems Chromium domination brings with it, this one takes a more positive look ahead at how things will likely be changing for both developers and users. For instance, the increasing homogeneity in rendering engines means that users can expect a lot of the web to work as intended with consistency. It also means less time testing for developers, which means fixes can get in front of people's eyes faster. Those things, however, don't come without some amount of risk. He also discusses the challenges involved when one entity has power and control over the market in a field driven by standards. This can be tempered by the small players in the field, though, and a reminder that Microsoft's commitment to Chromium is an ironic contrast from a company that itself was once the leader in the browser market. At any rate, be sure to check out both articles at Ferdy's blog. They aren't short reads, but they are deeply interesting and take a valuable look at how the browser engines impact the work that we do in our field. It may well impact your own strategy and workflow in the coming years. And finally this week, we have a piece on accessibility at the 24 Ways blog from Scott O'Hara. Inclusive considerations when restyling form controls. So, speaking of rendering engines, one of the most consistently frustrating and time-consuming processes that you can go through as a front-end developer is styling forms and trying to get them the same across devices, especially when the design asks for very particular styling. This challenge becomes even more detailed, though, when you start trying to ensure that those styles are also accessible. After all, making something match a design is only part of the battle. Sometimes this discussion sounds a little silly because some parts of forms, the most common ones, are relatively easy to style. But when you start dealing with the fields that imply different behavior, that's where we learn just how hard this process is. For instance, I'm talking about date fields and sliders, file uploads, and others. It's a common tactic to replace date pickers with custom JavaScript solutions in order to meet design requirements, but you can also implement those in a way that can break the underlying feature for users that don't get the special feature you deployed. That's where accessibility and inclusive design factors into your design strategy. Scott looks at a number of these use cases and form elements, providing a discussion on how to style the elements, what the limitations are, and the accessibility considerations to keep in mind when working with it. Definitely swing by the 24 Ways blog and give this a read before you build your next form to make sure you're considering all of the best practices before moving forward. Thanks for listening to Real Time Overview today, and we hope that you found these selections helpful for whatever it is that you are working on this week. For the Drunken UX Podcast, I am Michael Feenan. If you want to get the links to any of the articles from today's episode, be sure to swing by our website at drunkenux.com. We'll have all of them linked in the show notes there. Tune in this coming Wednesday for Build Process number 7, where I sit down to talk with Caleb Smith and John Kiefer from DevSquared about how they got into web development and the advice they have for young developers. You won't want to miss it. And for now, the last thing I can think of to leave you with is to tell you to keep your personas close and your users closer.